Welcome to Conversations with Consequences on EWTN Radio. I'm your hostess, Betsy Fentress.
And I'm Ashley McGuire.
And we're really grateful to have Monsignor Roger Landry with us. He's a member of our TCA team, and he serves as the National Director of the Pontifical Mission Societies, but he's really become our resident TCA chaplain, and boy, do we need him today, as there's been a lot of tragic news, including the shooting at Annunciation Catholic School in Minneapolis that claimed the lives of two students at a mass, and just last week, the assassination of conservative Christian activist Charlie Kirk. We really want to have you on today, Monsignor, and talk about how we approach this as Catholics and how we process this, especially since you've been a college chaplain.
I think the first thing we always do as Catholics, no matter what we're talking about, is to pray, because we live different lives. We respond to everything, both the joys and the terrible sorrows, not to mention the atrocities you just named, differently from the average person. We turn to God and we confront it with God. And so the first thing we have to do when we hear about the evils just described is we turn to God and we ask for his forgiveness. We do reparations. Charlie Kirk was a beloved son of God by baptism, and he was unceremoniously murdered in front of a crowd of 3,000. Those beautiful kids who had come together in Minneapolis to worship God, they were struck dead at the beginning of a school year, at the beginning of a mass. What a horror that is. And the one who weeps the most are not the parents who haven't stopped crying, not the pastor who's asked for God's help, not the archbishop, but it's ultimately God. He didn't create them to be slain in that way any more than he created Abel to be killed by his brother Cain. And so the first thing we do is we turn to God and we say, so sorry, Lord, and we need your help. So prayers for reparation have got to be our first response to the negative news that happens in the middle of the world. But then, as we grieve because of Charlie, for example's life, cut down a tree in its real vigor who was producing a lot of fruit, as we think about how much potential was slain with the two kids who were killed in Minneapolis, as well as the two adults who were trying to worship God with them, as we grieve for them with a real deep sorrow. As St. Paul said to the first Christians in Thessalonica, we grieve, but we do not grieve like those who have no hope. We grieve because we know Christ is with us in the midst of that sorrow. We grieve differently than the rest because we have hope. And in this jubilee of hope, we got to talk about what that hope is. The first reason for our hope that we've got to always be ready to give an explanation of to others, the first reason is because God with us, Emmanuel, is still very much with us in the middle of the world. The second reason we have hope is because he has not left us orphans, and He who died on Calvary to triumph over sin and death, his fruits, for example, those young kids believed in, Charlie Kirk believed in, and he himself announced in so many of his campus visits. And then the real third reason for our hope is because of the divine summons God has given us from our baptism on, that death is not the end, that a crucifixion couldn't even keep Jesus down, and assassins' bullets are not going to be able to keep those in Minneapolis down or Charlie Kirk down. And so we grieve, but we grieve with hope. Those are, I think, our first two reactions to the atrocities that we're all very much mourning.
Monsignor, we've become very accustomed to gun violence, to tragedies almost daily in the news, and people have been commenting on how we almost seem numb. Can you reflect, especially as a priest, in your capacity as a priest, on why you think his death is being felt so deeply by so many, including those who didn't agree with his politics?
I think almost everyone, and sadly there are a few who aren't described by this, but almost everyone, even if they disagreed with various of his political positions, recognized a few things about him. First, he was a husband, a dad, a son. He was a friend to many. And Like, how can we not mourn with those who have just lost a husband, a dad, a son, a friend? That's, I think, number one. Everybody can identify. Second, the way that he died, this type of assassination in the arena of a college campus touches us all. Like, anybody who's had anybody go to school, not to mention university, anybody who wants it to be a place of free learning. That's why Charlie was there a week plus ago. And to see him in the middle of that outreach, taken down, and anybody who's made the unfortunate mistake of seeing the video of what happened after he was shot, we're never going to forget it. There's no possible way we as human beings can't forget it. But then I think there's something deep down in all of us that resonates with what the great poet John Donne once said. Don't ask for whom that bell tolls. It tolls for thee. That there's part of us that puts ourselves at our best in the courageous position of a Charlie Kirk, basically reliving the biblical scene of Daniel in the lion's den, regularly willing to go into very uncomfortable circumstances from which 99% of people would shirk and be true to who he was. And like, I think part of us all wants to be Charlie Kirk at his best. Many of us don't live up to that aspiration. And it is a blow to the solar plexus when someone living that way in the very act of outreach is martyred. To use a very secular term, martyred, not in our Catholic theological sense, because I don't think he was slain specifically for his testimony to Jesus. That was a very important part of who Charlie was, but it seems, at least from what we know, he was attacked because of various political positions, but he died for those political decisions. And in the same way, we still mourn the loss of the death of Socrates. And we mourn for Charlie. And how can, in the Minnesota case, how can we not grieve for all of those families who have just lost their beloved loved ones who were just going to school? Everyone on the planet can relate to being there in school and to having so many loved ones whom we send off to school with kisses and the whole rest, full of hope, to see that happen. Has to touch us at the core of our humanity. And we are as corrupt as the devil would hope for if our heart doesn't bleed because of these terrible events.
Monsignor, I wanted to point out that Ashley had a piece in the New York Post last Friday, and she writes about anti-Christian sentiment, and I'm quoting her, "The Family Research Council has recorded more than 500 attacks on Catholic parishes since 2020 and more than 400 on Christian houses of worship last year alone. Jewish organizations in the U.S. must spend a staggering $765 million a year on security." You travel all over the world in your mission work. Talk about why Christians and Catholics recently are so prone to being targets.
I think there are a few reasons, starting at the deepest reason, because the devil hates our guts, because we are united to Jesus. And so the principalities and the powers about which St. Paul has written are actively revulsing against Christ and anyone to whom he belongs. And so that's the deepest reason of them all. And real malevolence exists in a personified way. The second reason is because, as some have said, anti-Catholicism is the last acceptable prejudice. And why are so many opposed to the church? It's ultimately because of what we stand for in the middle of the world. I had to confront it when I was helping the Holy See as a diplomat at the United Nations for 7 years here in New York, that many people oppose the church's teaching on certain issues, but especially issues with regard to who we are as men and women made in God's image and likeness, about the meaning of human love, about marriage, about sexuality, about children, how ending the lives of people at the beginning, middle, and end of life is wrong in every circumstance, you name it, that people oppose those positions, and they recognize that if the church is strong and exists, we are opposed to the revolution that they're trying to bring about. And so if they want to win, they think we have to get out of the way, either because we're too intimidated or because they seek to end our lives. Why have we had so many waves of martyrdom over the course of centuries? Now, in the United States, most of that opposition comes from militant and aggressive secularists. Secularism means that they want to live in a godless world, to live as if God doesn't exist. And those of us who witness to the presence of God among us, that God with us is still very much with us, we confront that whole secularist idea. And they can say we're trying to force immorality on them. We are not. We're freely trying to propose a better way to life. But they who want to impose their immorality on the world recognize that we're an existential threat to those ideas. And we've got a 2,000-year pedigree giving joint witness with us. And so I think that that's the second reason that fuels the hatred that leads to the desecration, not just of religious worship sites, our churches, our synagogues, but likewise, those of us who try to live together with God as living signs, and for Christians, as temples of God among us. And so we see that desecration quite a bit, and it is growing. I mean, most of the acts against religious believers across the world, by far, 80% of them happen against Christians. And in many places, we turn a blind eye to that. Why? Because of this neo-Marxism we're seeing on campuses that Charlie Kirk battled vigorously. And the neo-Marxists all think that everything is a struggle between victimizers and victims. And those are two hard classes. You're either in one or the other. And they think that Catholics are in the victimizer class, and that they are in the victim class, and you name these multiple intersecting groups that you'll hear them try to talk about, that if you're in that victim class, the end justifies the means in attacking and eliminating the victimizers. And so that is particularly something that Charlie capably argued against and persuaded tens of thousands of college students to abandon. And for that, we all owe them a great thank you.
There's no question that among young people, Gen Z, this is has to be one of the if not the most significant events to occur for them in terms of how it's impacting them. But, you know, I've talked to a lot of parents, older generation, Gen X, millennial, even boomers, who have a shared concern, which is, you know, I'm a mom of five. Betsy has six children. They're having grandchildren. What is the future? The common question is, what is the future of civil discourse after, in a post Charlie Kirk assassination world? Are our children safe? Can they safely engage in discourse when it literally gets you killed?
I think we have to prepare them for that discourse, knowing that the risks are small. I mean, thanks be to God, we're not having assassinations every day like occurred at Utah Valley State University. Thanks be to God. I am hopeful we're never going to get there. But that future is determined by the choices we make. We're not in control totally at an individual level of the outcome, but we do have an impact on that outcome. And we've got to use our freedom now to act. One of the things that the vast majority of people have seen in every generation over the course of this last week plus is that we want our campuses not to be places of indoctrination. We certainly don't want them to be places of violence. We want them to be places in which we can have conversations about the things that matter most. And we can bring about that reality. But what it's going to require first is that all of us look at what happened to Charlie as a moment of conversion, to ask, have I contributed at all to it by my type of occasionally overzealous opposition to other human beings with ideas contrary to my own? There's a lot of that that goes around. And to be blunt, a lot of people vote for it, where we're voting for a culture in which some of our major leaders insult their friends on the same time, in the same side, sort of shooting with friendly fire, even those who, for the most part, agree with them. Not to mention against those, we don't have to make it existential. One of the problems that Charlie was fighting against is many of the progressives on the far left think that if you disagree with them, you are, by that very nature, a hater. And if you're a hater in who you are, how can I ever have an argument with you? How can I ever sort of coexist with hatred? Who wants to live with hatred? A lot of the times they have not God in their life. They don't know what to do in terms of those with whom they're struggling, you name it. They just want to eliminate the ones that they label unjustly as haters. And so, like, but sometimes we've got to ask, like, what the heck is Attorney General Pam Bondi doing in these last couple of days? Not to get overly political, but basically saying, we're going to come after you and not allow you even to have basic free speech, no matter what, like, to disagree, right? To disagree. We, on the, throughout our entire culture, we're having those on the right, not to mention just those on the left, now saying things and behaving in a way that's not going to birth a culture in which we can respect each other enough truly to disagree and try to have conversations by which we can persuade somebody to our own opinion. We've all got a big role to play in creating that culture. And to the heart of your question, Ashley, which is a really very, very important one, with parents and grandparents and godparents loving their children and having legitimate fears about what the future may portend. For us Christians, we need to raise our young people to cooperate with the gifts of the Holy Spirit. And one of those gifts that our age so much needs is the gift of courage. I think on Charlie Kirk's final report card, when he met Jesus for his face-to-face oral exam, that he would have gotten 100 out of 100 on the courage score. It took a lot of courage to do what he was doing. But we need to raise kids with that type of courage. I'll never forget the way the Japanese, in the time of ferocious anti-persecution, used to train their kids from their youngest days to be courageous in the supreme hour. So when they were teaching their kids to make the sign of the cross, they were teaching in the meaning of the cross, that remember, when we make the sign, we're entering into God, Father, Son, and Holy Spirit. We're entering into the Trinity, and we're taking Jesus's cross onto us. What happened to Jesus on the cross? Well, he died, but what happened right after he died? He went into heaven. What will happen to us if we die together with Jesus when we die? Well, we hope to go to heaven, right? And what happens even if we die being martyred on a cross or being decapitated or of a death march or you name it? What's going to happen to us? Well, we hope to die. When they were teaching their kids the Hail Mary, what does it mean to say, Holy Mary, Mother of God, pray for us sinners now and at the hour of our death? So like at the hour of our death, please know if your mom and your dad die before you by the bad guys, please remember that Mary's praying for us at the hour of our death. And so her prayers are very, very powerful, and they're going to help us. And likewise, if you're dying, know that you're not dying alone, that Mary's going to be praying for you at the hour of your death and praying for you now. And I could say basically everything that the Japanese were catechizing their kids, they were preparing them to give witness. And that's what occurred. When you read the accounts of the Japanese martyrs, the samurais would always go after the parents first to try to scare the young children. And the children would respond with great faith. There was one kid, Peter Satori, who watched his father be decapitated. And it's one of the most powerful stories, I think, in all of hagiography. He went over and he lovingly embraced his father's head. And then the same samurai who finished his father's life came toward little Peter. And what Peter did is he just exposed his neck. He thought it was neck. He was next. The samurai balked at the courage of a five-year-old who was really prepared to give testimony. And again, as I say a lot, because frankly, when I was in college, I received death threats through some of my own campus activism at Harvard. I'll save you the details about that.
Wow.
But I've never forgotten what the Boston Globe asked me in an interview. They said, when somebody called up and said, we're going to be waiting outside of Mather 425 with an AIDS-infected needle, and if we get you, great. If we get one of your roommates, great too, because then you're going to have to learn how to commiserate. The Boston Globe reporter asked me, did that make you afraid? And then the reporter said he thought about it for a second and with no seeming bravado said no, because I'm just not going to allow those people to intimidate. And if ultimately you're not afraid to die, then you're not going to be afraid to go onto college campuses. You're not going to be afraid of a little suffering. You're not going to be afraid of this. And we Christians, and I know that this is the most challenging part of our faith, but we Christians have signed up voluntarily with faith to follow the happiest person who has ever lived on the way of the cross. And when we look at him raised up on Calvary, we're seeing the happiest person at the supreme moment of his triumph. And so as we marked on Sunday with the feast of the triumph or the exaltation of the cross, when we look there, we're not filled with shame. We're filled with courage, because the same Lord who did that wants to strengthen us to be strong in bearing witness to him, as the church prays in the preface of martyrs, to be strong in bearing witness to him through Christ our Lord. And so this is part of the gospel, as challenging as it is, that as we follow the Lord on that narrow way, step by step in his bloody footprints, he's with us to strengthen us just like he strengthened the martyrs of every age. And if we live our faith with that type of courage, I'm not afraid for the future.
Monsignor, I read that there's been an uptick on college campuses and in parishes of people at Mass last weekend. You were the chaplain at Columbia University, which certainly has had a lot of unrest in the last year. What are some of the things that you did to bring students together, perhaps who even disagreed, or how to be a witness on a campus where they're in the minority? Tell us about some of the tactics or events that you held in an effort to bridge that divide.
So we're living in an age in which the young people, having experienced the COVID pandemic and all its associated disruptions, are now open to an alternative explanation than what many in our culture want to give them, and many on college campuses want to indoctrinate them with. They're open to something else, and we've got to have confidence in the church's alternative proposal, that we think it's a much better proposal and a much better way to live. When Columbia was going through the crisis that was leading to the protests on campus and things, what I tried to do is to articulate, as Catholics, we don't protest. It's Protestants who protest. We Catholics stand for things. And what do we stand for? And so they're going to be encamping themselves on a college campus, but their grass stains are not going to change what's going on in one of the most intractable political disputes in modern history between Israel and the Palestinians. What can we do? We can encamp ourselves before the Lord in prayer. We can pull all-nighters here. If you'd like to join me in encamping ourselves before the Lord Jesus, we're going to do it. What do we stand for? We stand for real charity. Charity toward our Jewish brothers and sisters on campus. Charity toward our Muslim brothers and sisters on campus. Charity even toward those who have no charity toward us. And so how can we reach out in these types of contexts? I said, we Catholics, we have the gift of the Holy Spirit and the gift of courage. There are a lot of our fellow students who are afraid. How can we bring our courage to strengthen them in a very practical way? Can we accompany some students to class who might be afraid? Can we let them know we have their back and we have their front and we have their feet, and like we're going to care for them because we're Catholic and we are people for others? You know, and I just started to give a litany of the types of things we do as Catholics, because our faith, if it's real, can't be inconsequential. And so our faith means we know God's with us. Second, our hope in all Jesus's promises. So we're going to be far less vulnerable to the intimidation of the bullies on campus than others are. Love for God and real love for others, willing to sacrifice for them, willing to suffer for them, ultimately like Jesus, willing to die for them. If that's our approach, everything changes. And that's where the real revolution happens. If we allow our faith to transform us in that way, Jesus through us will use us to transform our campuses, to transform our cities, to transform our culture, and as salt, light, and leaven, change the whole world.
That's a beautiful way to end. And we can also be basking in the glow of our two new saints for young people. To learn more about Monsignor Roger Landry, please visit catholicpreaching.com. And to read Ashley McGuire's piece on Charlie Kirk, make sure to visit nypost.com. Thank you for having. Thank you for being with us today, Monsignor.
God bless you, Betsy. God bless you, Ashley.
Welcome to Conversations with Consequences here on EWTN Radio. I'm your host, Mary Fiorito.
And I'm Betsy Fentress.
And we are thrilled to have with us today Edward Penton, the senior Vatican correspondent for the National Catholic Register. He is known for his fine reporting and his in-depth analysis of different issues. And today we're going to discuss something very close to home for him, both literally and figuratively. This week, the Duchess of Kent was laid to rest. She was a convert to Catholicism and the first senior member of the royal family to become a Catholic in 300 years. She was 92 years old, and marking another first, King Charles was in attendance, as were Prince William and Princess Catherine and many other members of the royal family. Edward, thank you for making time for us today to discuss this rather unusual funeral in England yesterday.
Sure. Happy to be with you.
So it was reported, and been a lot of follow-up stories this week, that King Charles's presence marked the first time a reigning British monarch has attended a Catholic funeral in a formal capacity on UK grounds since the Reformation. Can you tell us what this historic event meant for you as an Englishman as well as a Catholic?
Yes, well, it was very significant. As you say, it's a real first. It was also a first in the sense that it was the first royal funeral at Westminster Cathedral since the cathedral was built, and that's only over 100 years ago. So yes, it was a very historic event. And she, as many listeners may know, the Duchess of Kent, converted to the faith in 1994. And when she did so, that was a very big event as well, of course, because that was the first conversion of the royal family who stayed in the royal family. There was, I think, the granddaughter of Queen Victoria who converted and married a Spanish member of the royal family. But for somebody who's actually remained within the royal family until her death, this was the first member of the royals to convert. And really since the 17th century, when I think King Charles II converted on his deathbed, as we believe. So yes, it was really very much a historic event. And the Duchess was a very popular royal as well. She was very much loved. She was a great, did a lot of things for the community. She did a lot of things for charity. She was very much committed to her faith, and all that showed in her public work.
Yes, and her son, Lord Nicholas Windsor, who, if I recall correctly, was the page boy at Charles and Diana's wedding, he also followed her into the Catholic Church.
Indeed, yes, you're exactly right. Yes, he was the page boy. And yes, and he converted in 2001, I believe. And yes, he was the first blood royal, because the Duchess was a commoner. She wasn't
right.
a royal herself.
Because she married the Duke of Kent, right.
Exactly, she married yes. the Duke of Kent, who was Queen Elizabeth's first cousin. And Nicholas, Lord Nicholas, when he converted, he's the first blood royal male of the male line to convert. So, and then I believe that a granddaughter has converted. I can't remember her name, but a granddaughter of the Duchess has also become a Catholic. So she had a great effect on her own family as well.
So Edward, for our listeners who maybe don't understand or aren't up to date on how this all plays out in British public life, why is it such a big deal that she was a Catholic? And is there a lot of prejudice today still in the UK towards Catholics?
Yes, it's a good question, Betsy. I the reason why it's such a major story, of course, is our history of Catholic history, and the fact that there was the break from Rome with Henry VIII. And, you know, that was a very serious time. I was just talking to somebody earlier today that we were discussing the effects of the Reformation, and really it terrorized the country, and it's still feeling the effects now. I mean, it's never really recovered from that. And for many, many years, I mean, centuries, there was prejudice against Catholics since the Reformation. That's only recently, relatively recently, died away, and there is still remnants of it, of course. But it really is. It was something that really hung over from the Reformation for a long, long time. And you know, you'd had people talking about popery and all of that up until relatively recently. And that made it difficult for people to convert. Cardinal John Henry Newman, of course, had to make a lot of sacrifices when he converted, and many did, and it was very, very difficult. But by 1994, it was obviously relatively easy compared to how it used to be. So it wasn't without challenge, and she said she pondered it a long time, the Duchess of Kent, before taking that decision. And so she obviously, you know, she knew the consequences of it. She knew the meaning of it in terms of British history, but she had the courage to do it anyway. And she had a great love for the faith and a real strong belief, the belief of the faith as well.
Edward, is it true that Princess Diana's mother also converted to Catholicism later in life?
I haven't heard that.
Okay.
I don't know about that, but I have heard from somebody who, a friend of mine actually, who knows her, knew her quite well, that she was very much close to Princess Diana, and in fact was a sort of mentor to her. So it was interesting. You saw that great service to the community and to others, and especially to the downtrodden, which they both had. And I think it's a lot of it, I think, perhaps came from the Duchess of Kent.
Well, and something of, it's not quite a first, but certainly is unusual enough that it made the news, is that there was a special telegram sent from our new Holy Father, Pope Leo XIV, and it's quite beautiful. He says, "Entrusting her noble soul to the mercy of our Heavenly Father, I readily associate myself with all those offering thanksgiving to Almighty God for the Duchess's legacy of Christian goodness, seen in her many years of dedication to official duties, the patronage of charities, and devoted care for vulnerable people in society." I mean, to have the Holy Father say those kind of things about you, I know we
yes.
don't instantly canonize people, but that comes frighteningly, remarkably close. But tell us about a little bit of the work she did, particularly her work as an art teacher for underprivileged children.
Yes, I mean, this is what she became very well known for. She had a great love of music and a great love of teaching and a great love for young people. And so that all combined together. And when she stood down from public duties, quite a while ago. I think it was sort of late 90s, really. She was not one who really liked the limelight anyway, and she was much happier teaching and being with young people. And so she, for I think 13 years, she taught in a school in Hull, which is in northern England. She came from Yorkshire, so she was returned to the north, and taught the groups of secondary school children, I think, or primary school children, music. But she did so totally anonymously, and she said that, you know, even the parents didn't know who she was. Only the headmaster knew, and she just used to teach them under the name of Mrs. Kent, not, of course, Duchess of Kent. And nobody recognised her, and she was quite happily doing that for many, many years. And yes, and I think that just shows her sort of her, as I say, her love for young people and music, and just being in contact with people and just helping them in their everyday lives. And she set up a charity too called Future Talent, which helped young people, especially in deprived areas. So the other thing pointed about these children were that they were all from deprived, very deprived areas. They were very poor, and she set up this talent, this charity to really help poor children to learn music, which he said was had a great effect on them and really helped them. You know, it helped encourage them, it helped give them inspire them to do things. And she said it was great effect that music had on them. And so she was very keen to teach that and spread that among the children there.
Edward, you've written about her conversion, which some say was marked by personal loss and suffering. While she was pregnant with her fourth child in 1975, she contracted measles and, following her doctor's advice, terminated the pregnancy for medical reasons. So, can you tell us a little bit more about that story?
Yes, so that's exactly what happened. And as the story goes, that the doctors gave the advice, because she had measles, to terminate the pregnancy, but she was regretted it. And in fact, only a couple of years later, she gave a speech when she was pregnant again, underlining the importance of life, the miracle of life, and that every human life is of inestimable worth. And she gave this talk, I can't remember where exactly, but it was delivered in her place because she was heavily pregnant. And then tragically, 36 weeks pregnant, she had a miscarriage, and she was obviously deeply hurt by this, and was very distraught. And she saw it, in fact, as a sort of punishment for the termination that she'd had 2 years earlier. So it really affected her, and I think gave her a lot of empathy for those who have had gone through similar experiences, whether miscarriage or abortion. And it certainly, I think, had an effect on her, and helped bring her to the faith, perhaps. I think she was probably on her way anyway, but it, as I say, it gave that very deep sense of empathy that she had for those who'd gone through similar experiences. And in fact, her son, Lord Nicholas, has been very strong on pro-life issues himself. I think he understood as well the impact that that had on his mother, and how much it has on other people too.
Did she come out at all about the assisted suicide that's going through the parliament discussions in any way? Because that would seem to be a perfect, follow-up to her support for the
It
unborn.
would, but the royal family tend not to enter into any of these disputes. They know their constitutional role, which, rightly or wrongly, means that they're very reluctant to enter into any kind of political disputes. The king won't do it. The Queen Elizabeth never really did it, and so they try not to. They try to stay clear of that. And in fact, that speech that she gave in 1977 was seen as, you know, quite a departure in a way, because she was starting to wade in to the abortion debate, was only about 10 years old by that time. The Abortion Act was passed in 67. And so I think she was starting to raise a few eyebrows, perhaps, among the sort of establishment that she was entering into that debate. So she tended not to. And yes, I think that was her own, obviously her own decision. But she was also very much a rather reclusive person. I mean, she didn't like to be in the public eye very much. And as I say, after she stepped down from public duties, we hardly ever saw her. She used to appear a lot at Wimbledon up until the sort of mid-90s. But then we didn't really see much of her after that.
You know, Edward, I've asked our friends over at Google, and I was correct. Diana's mother, Frances Shand Kidd, also converted to Catholicism in 1994, so the same year that the Duchess of Kent became a Catholic, and she made annual pilgrimages to Lourdes as a carer for disabled people. And then, of course, she was the one who organized that big fundraiser for the families who were impacted by the Lockerbie terrorist bombing of that plane. So that's interesting because they certainly must have known each other, and that they came into the church the same year, which I had not realized until just this very moment. It's and again, and then she went to like some remote part of Scotland, to Argyll, I think, or something. And so she kind of like the Duchess of Kent was I don't know if I would describe her as a recluse, but certainly she kept herself to herself.
Yes, indeed. That's true. And she did like to make very many pilgrimages to Lourdes and Our Lady of Walsingham, the shrine there, in the basically the national shrine in England to Our Lady. And so she did that. In fact, as an Anglican, she went there with the Archbishop of Canterbury. There's an Anglican shrine there as well as a Catholic one. And before her conversion, she went there with the Archbishop. Because it was really because of the trauma that she went through after the miscarriage that she went there for solace. She said she found great solace in the faith, and she loved the guidelines of the faith. She wanted clear guidelines, and that seemed to be what really attracted her to it. And as I say, the solace of it in the amidst the suffering that she faced.
It's interesting that you bring that up about the guidelines because, Edward, you've also been watching the rise of young men in Great Britain turning to faith. So, can you talk a little bit about that and how both the Duchess of Kent and these young men, what they see in the church that they're not getting anywhere else?
Yes, well, it's interesting. I mean, certainly from that Anglican background that she had, there was a sense also at the time of her conversion that there was a lot of influx. There was the 3 years earlier, I think they'd had the vote to allow women priests in the Anglican Communion, the Church of England, rather. And so I think there was a sense of wanting something, that was traditional, handed down, that doesn't change, that's immutable, the immutable truths of the faith. And I think there was a lot of attraction there for the Catholic Church in that sense. She didn't like to enter into the controversies, and that wasn't a major part for her of her conversion, she said. But at the same time, she did value that clarity of teaching and the unchangeable teaching of the Catholic Church. And I think that's similar to what young people and especially young men today are looking for as well. And that's what they see in the Catholic Church, certainly the traditional. A lot of them are flocking to the sort of traditional rites of the Catholic Church, the old rite, because they see in that not only the unchangeable teaching there, but also the beauty of the liturgy, and the unchanging nature of it all, and the great reverence and the silence and various other factors which attracts them to it. So yes, that's what we're seeing, and I think it seems to be growing quite quickly here. I keep hearing different stories about how very many young men, particularly, are coming to the old mass. So it's an interesting phenomenon, yes. And the Duchess of Kent used to go regularly to the Brompton Oratory, which is also has Latin masses there, and in the new rite too. But it's always Ad Orientem in a very traditional way, and that's attracting lots of people as well, young people especially.
Edward, what kind of liturgy, funeral liturgy, would the Duchess have had? I've heard it referred to, the New York Times referred to it this morning as a Requiem Mass, and I've seen the cover of what looked like it was the funeral program. But were cameras allowed inside the church? Do we have any idea, who preached? Was it in Latin? Were there any particular songs that she chose?
That's a good question. I don't know what the liturgy was exactly. I think it was, I know that the music that was played, we had Ave Verum Corpus by Mozart, which was one of her favorite pieces. And then we had music by J.S. Bach and from the Requiem by Maurice de Roufflay. And so there were various things, favorite, obviously favorite pieces of music that she liked. But I don't know what the exact liturgy was. Cardinal Vincent Nichols, the Archbishop of Westminster, presided over the Mass, the Requiem Mass. And so that's all we know really at the moment. But I'll try and find out what the actual liturgy was. But it was very private, though. That's the thing. There were no cameras. I think I've only seen one picture of the inside of the cathedral. But no more. So yeah, it was very restricted.
Okay, yeah, because I you the different news channels, the BBC and what have you, that were doing sort of live coverage, I kept checking in occasionally, thinking they'll go into the church in a moment, but you just saw a smattering of people going in, and maybe that was for security reasons too, because it seemed to be all the senior members of the royal family were present. The Princess Royal
Yes.
was there, and I think I saw Sarah Ferguson. And of course, William and Catherine. And were you surprised that there was such a strong showing from the Holy Father, given the religious dif or for I'm sorry, for the Duchess, given the religious differences?
Well, in a sense, yes, but as I say, she was very popular and I think much loved also obviously by the royal family as well as the public. And I think there was just a general willingness to bid her farewell and pay their respects. And so, yes, I think that was the main reason. The Queen Camilla didn't make it because she was sick, but I think otherwise everybody was there who was members of the royal family. So yeah, it was a good turnout in that sense. And there were some famous people there too from, the world of sport and entertainment. Not many, but there are some.
Wasn't there that race car driver, who am I thinking of? Stewart?
Yes.
Is that, yeah, I believe he was there.
Yes, he was there. That's right. I saw that. Yes.
Yeah,
So
very interesting, just for people watching. But when Charles took the oath to become, or oaths, because I guess he takes a separate one in Scotland, did he declare to be the defender of faiths, plural, or is he still considered the defender of the faith, and in his mind, the head of the Church of England?
I believe it's still the defender of the faith. He was talked about many years ago when he was Prince of Wales that he wanted to become the defender of faith. But I don't think that's ever been formally pronounced. I think he may think that, of course, in his own mind, because he is very open-minded about different faiths. And it seems to want to embrace them all. But yes, I think. But I don't think it's changed anything formally in that sense. No.
Edward, I like to keep going back to her conversion story because I'm fascinated by it. And I believe that you are also a convert. Is that correct?
I am, yes. I
Is
was an
it
Anglican.
is that a hard jump to make in England, socially, within families? Can you tell us a little bit about that and what it's like? Do you feel like you're leaving, a big club for a much smaller club?
Well, in a sense, yes. I mean, it does still feel very much so like coming home, as every convert says, and
Nice.
it there's no doubt about that. But it is not easy though, in the sense that the culture is not the same. Of course, there's a very much an English culture of the Church of England. Some say it's more the C of E, they call it, and some say it's more E than C. It's more England than church, because it is very much a sort of based around the nation and the national culture and and everything to do with what is England. But actually, becoming a Catholic, you realize that the real sense of England, the great richness of England, comes from its Catholic past. The great, the common law and all of the great aspects of our culture really come from pre-Reformation England. Well, that's a controversial thing to say, but I think that's a sense one gets when one becomes a Catholic. You're going back to the roots very much of the deep, deep roots of England, which go much deeper than going back to the 16th century. So, but it is difficult in that sense of leaving behind that very English culture, if you like. But it's very much a superficial one, in terms of its, the trappings of the culture, to go somewhere much, much deeper, which is into to the Catholic faith.
And you know what's so touching to me is that she obviously sidelined herself a little bit by becoming a Catholic as a working royal. But then you look at now in her death, King Charles is at a Catholic funeral mass because of her and her courage and her witness. Why would he have not attended or the Queen would not have attended the funerals of John Paul II and then the King for Pope Francis? Is that because those are state events that they would have sent Prince William in their stead? The Prince of Wales went to both of those in both cases, I believe.
Yes, I'm not quite sure what the sort of protocol is for that. It can sometimes just be the availability that they have other things that they've had, because of course the funeral is not something you can plan ahead on. Whether that's the reason, I'm not sure. Yes, I think, yeah, it's I wouldn't know that, but it's certainly there's ever-growing sympathy for the Catholic Church. It seems to be in the royal family, and the Queen Elizabeth had a lot of time for the Catholic faith, yes.
And when St. John Paul II met with her, I believe they discussed some issues that pertained to faith, and he had some very complimentary things to say about her as a woman of faith, which was, very encouraging to hear. And I hope this is perhaps a another way in which those religious tensions, in the north of Ireland and Scotland and in England can all ease a little bit towards Catholics and Protestants, towards each other, because it is something that, kind of to this day, and I guess depending on what football team you're supporting as well there, that's the other
Yes.
great, maybe we'll discover a way to mend the Catholic Protestant fence before we mend, the Rangers and Celtic. So
Well, there's a lot's been done since, thanks to the Queen, in fact, and to just general efforts behind the scenes as well, bringing, those two sides together. It's amazing, of course, when you look at what's happened in Ireland and how that's changed over the past 20, 30 years. Things have really moved on quite a lot in that sense. But of course, there is the danger with ecumenism always, that it can blur the lines between the two, and people always think, well, perhaps they're just the same and there isn't much difference between them, when in fact there is significant differences, in terms of the sacraments and so forth. So that's always something that one has to, I think, be wary of when it comes to this. And the fact that the Duchess of Kent decided to become a Catholic, I think, shows that she understood that, and she could see that there was a difference, and that the difference was worth making the sacrifice for.
Well, we will join you and all of your countrymen in praying for the repose of her soul. And thank you so much for giving us this generous amount of time today, Edward. To learn more about Edward Penton and catch all of his writings, you can go to the National Catholic Register by visiting ncregister.com. And to learn more about us at the Catholic Association and follow everything that we do in radio, TV, and print online in our local communities, you can go to thecatholicassociation.org. Edward, thank you again for joining Betsy and me today.
My pleasure. Good to be with you, Ben.